Please join me in a warm welcome for Jim Lentz.
Thank you.
Moderating our program today is John McElroy. John is an influential thought leader in the automotive industry and is widely known host of AutoLine Daily, the first industry webcast of automotive news, the host of television program AutoLine This Week, and co-host of AutoLine After Hours. John also broadcasts three radio segments daily on WWJ News Radio 950, so he knows a thing or two about the automotive industry and the direction it is taking. With a background like this, it should come as no surprise that John was inducted into the Michigan Journalism Hall of Fame in 2018. Please join me in a warm Detroit and Economic Club welcome for Jim Lentz and John McElroy. Thank you. John, take it away.
We'll do it. Well, hello, everybody. This is going to be a lot of fun for me, and I hope for you as well.
I hope for me, too.
And I hope for you as well, right?
Yikes.
So Jim and I are going to be talking about things going on at Toyota and the industry. We'll go for about a half hour. Then Rod will come back up on the stage and handle some of your questions, and I think he's got a round robin of quick-fire questions to launch at Jim as well. But let's talk about what's going on in the industry. Personally, I think this is the most exciting time in the history of the industry since 110 years ago. I think you had to go back 110 years when people like Henry Ford and David Dunbar Buick and Ransom Eli Olds were walking the streets of where we're right now. And here we are, fast forward to today, we're talking electrification, autonomy, connectivity, mobility. And Jim, I'd love to get your perspective on what Toyota thinks about mobility. How do you define it? And we hear a lot of car companies saying now we're no longer an automotive company, we're a mobility company. How does Toyota see it?
Well, I would agree with you. This is the most exciting time, interesting time, probably also the most hair-raising time to figure out how quickly all this is going to move. Because with all the automakers, that's the tough part. You're right, the big four, those are the questions. And I think all of us understand that those four big, meaty topics are where the future is going to be. But the question is, how quickly are we going to get there? So as we look at mobility, we define it kind of in the traditional way. And that is, from a traditional car standpoint, what are the powertrains we're going to put into vehicles? Are they going to be fuel cells? Are they going to be battery? Are they going to be hybrids? Are they going to be plug-ins? You know, how much can we advance our current technologies? But we also look at it from a standpoint of how do we get people, not necessarily through a vehicle across town, but how do we get people across the room? So if we look at the development that we're doing with artificial intelligence, that same research that will go into an autonomous car, will go into an autonomous wheelchair, will go into other devices that maybe can help the blind work their way around a mall. So we see autonomy as a really broad scope. And then you've got the aspect of this whole notion of mobility as a service. So not only how do you develop the electric vehicles, how do you develop the autonomous vehicles, but then how do you develop the business model that goes around that really makes sense?
What role do you think Toyota might play in that mobility as a service? We see various other automakers sticking their toe in the water. Waymo officially announced today it's launching its autonomous service in Phoenix. GM says it's going to be launching next year, others following in. Toyota's partnering with Uber right now, right?
Yep.
Where do you see Toyota's role as a mobility provider, service provider, or do you see that?
We do. I mean, we're tipping our toes in a number of different places, whether it's Uber, whether it's Grab, whether it's SoftBank, a number of different plays. Again, because we're trying to decide what is the hardware and the software that goes into the device, and then how do you make that into a business model to help society? So I think that the one difference we may have with many is we are strong believers in our dealers. In our franchise dealers. And we believe that anything that we do in the mobility field is going to include the dealers. We think that's a real point of strength for us. And I'll give you an example. We've developed a platform where from your cell phone, you sign up, and you're able to reserve a car, you're able to pay for a car, you're able to unlock your car and drive it. That platform is being tested now. It's called HUI. It's being tested in Hawaii by our distributor there called Surfco. And they have about 100 cars. It's a station-to-station deal, and they have had, I think, about 8,000 reservations already. So it's little tests like that that we're going to do to make sure that we've got the right product and the right process in place. But we think the dealers will be a big part of that.
You know, that's so interesting to hear. I have not heard one other OEM say that dealers are going to play a major role in our move to mobility. And when you think about it, dealerships are in every single community across the country. So
that's exactly
you don't
right.
just have to worry about being in a downtown area.
That's right. It's a strength for us because those cars have to be repositioned. They have to be maintained. They have to be cleaned. I mean, what better, you know, for us to start a whole new organization to do that is insanity when we've got the best dealer network in the country.
There you go. Seems to be Toyota, just going back a few years ago, wasn't all that interested in autonomy and mobility, and then I don't know what happened. You guys woke up one day and you formed the Toyota Research Institute, especially looking at artificial intelligence.
Yep.
I'm amazed that that effort is largely taking place in the United States, not back in Toyota's home
right.
country of Japan. And Michigan's playing a role in that. I guess that's a segue into a broader question. What role does Michigan hold for Toyota, especially as we move into this mobility future?
It's a huge role. I mean, our R&D headquarters is based here in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, New York. We've got 1,500 engineers. Toyota Research Institute has associations with a number of different universities. University of Michigan is one of them. So this is a huge part of that learning because this is where the global automotive talent is coming out of the great universities of Michigan. So it makes sense to be here, although I'll tell you, Michigan's going to start having some competition on that as well. University of Texas at Austin, there are a number of universities that see this as a future place for their students to find employment. But it's interesting. I think early on, when Akio Toyota took over the company, he's a professional race car driver. He loves cars, he loves driving. And the idea to Akio of letting a computer take over driving didn't really sit real well. I can remember having a number of conversations, and I think it was really when we hired Gil to head up the TRI, and that we took a little bit different tack than most, because everybody is really chasing the ultimate, and that's this chauffeur driving, where you can get in the back seat with a cocktail and it's gonna take you wherever you wanna go. And at some point in time that will happen, but that's a long time into the future. To us, mobility using autonomous vehicles is about saving lives. Because if you look at the fact that there are 36,000 deaths that take place a year, 98% are caused by driver error. So the fact that we can develop a car with the intelligence that can prevent those accidents from happening, to me, that's the benefit to society. That I put an Uber driver out of business, I could care less about that. It's really about what can we do for society. And I think that's what turned Akio, that he understood that by creating this chauffeur mode as well as the guardian mode, where as a driver, you're in control of that car. And it's monitoring everything going on around you. And if you're about to make a mistake that's going to cause injury to you or to a pedestrian, the car steps in and stops that. To me, that's the benefit of autonomy. You know, I have a 94-year-old father. We moved my parents to Texas when we moved down there. And it was tough taking the keys away from them. My kids will never have to do that. Because as my skills deteriorate with age, I'm gonna have the use of an autonomous vehicle that whether I'm piloting it or not, I'm going to have something that is smarter, faster reflexes to make up for my loss of reflex. So to me, that's the critical part. And for the industry, I think that's a good thing. There are a lot of boomers that eventually, we're gonna keep on buying cars into our 90s if we have cars that can improve our skills. So to me, there's a huge opportunity for this great industry to continue to grow. I understand mobility as a service. But the question to me really becomes, what is that displacing? Is it displacing taxis? And it is, because it's better service, it's cheaper, they're not as rude. Sorry, I hope there's not a taxi driver in the room. Is it going to help to augment public transportation? With cash-strapped cities, they don't have the dollars to put into future transportation systems. So I think it's going to help that as well.
You know, you mentioned 37,000 fatalities. That's just in the U.S.
Yeah, it's a
million. The World Health Organization says globally it's 1.2 million mm-hmm. killed mm-hmm. every single year in mm-hmm. motor vehicle accidents. The other thing, too, is that's just the fatalities. In the U.S. Right. alone, about 2.2 million people are injured badly enough in a motor vehicle accident to have to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
2.2 million every single year. Car accidents are the number one cause of closed head injuries, which, guess what, going to debilitate you for the mm-hmm. rest of your life. So when you talk about this brave new world and how we can yeah. save lives, imagine the impact on the U.S. healthcare system
right.
if every single year we send 2 million fewer people to the hospital. Could really
yeah.
pay off.
Yeah, and frankly, that number of injuries has actually gone up over time because the cars have become safer over time. A lot of those may have been fatalities in the past. They've now survived, but they may have horrendous injuries.
I also like Toyota's approach. You know, the SAE has come up with various levels
right.
of autonomy. Level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 being go in the back seat and take a nap because there's not even a steering wheel
right.
in the car. Toyota doesn't call it that. You guys call it chauffeur.
Right.
And below that, you call it guardian.
Yep.
And I'm intrigued by what you're talking about here in terms of life-saving and that being the driving impetus behind this, because with Guardian, you're still going to drive, but the way you guys are approaching it, it's your guardian angel.
Right.
You drive, but the car's never going to
right.
let you get in an accident.
Right.
Can you fill in some of
sure.
the details
and
your thinking?
You know, and the other part about that's interesting is, you know, you talk to people that love to drive cars, and they never want to have an autonomous car take over for them, but they can drive a lot more aggressively when they've got a guardian angel on their shoulder. So they're starting to figure this out, that this isn't necessarily a bad thing, I can do this. But it is just that. I mean, we believe, and the other important part about that is that today, if you ask the average consumer, do you want an autonomous car? It's overwhelming. 80% say, absolutely not. I never want to have a computer drive my car. So we're going to have to evolve over time and earn the trust of consumers before they ever get into a car without a steering wheel. And the best way to do that is for them to experience it. So today, if you look at the automatic braking systems and blind spot monitors and lane assist, all of that is starting to warm consumers up to the fact that these are going to save lives. I mean, I hate to say it, I've had my automatic braking go in a number of times, and it's a shocker, but I would have rear-ended people because I wasn't paying attention. So as you go from that and you evolve into this guardian mode, consumers are going to see that, you know, this is really a great safety item, and I'm beginning to trust this system to be able to do the right thing. So at some point in time down the road, that chauffeur mode's gonna go into play.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about how you handle this balance. Here you are running Toyota North America. You gotta put all this money and all this effort, engineering effort, into autonomy, mobility, and light. But right now, today, you gotta sell product. You gotta invest in that product as well. How do you determine which way the balance goes?
It's tough because, I mean, you're faced with the facts. And the fact is, if you put too much of your resource into today, you're going to trail the industry tomorrow. If you put too much resource into tomorrow, there may not be a tomorrow. Because you've got to sell cars and generate the cash. You've got to keep your customer base there so that at some point in time, you're going to sell those vehicles. So I think we always operate in a portfolio way. Whether it's powertrain, you know, we're going to continue to have internal combustion engines, hybrids, plug-in hybrids, fuel cells, and EVs. And we'll have a strategy on where we think it's headed. And we just have to be agile enough to change as we go through and say, okay, at some point in time, internal combustion engines are going to go by the wayside. And maybe traditional hybrids go by the wayside. And we're left with plug-ins and batteries and fuel cells. We have to do that same thing today with model lineups. We have to take a hard look at what adds value to our consumers and to the company. Where do we generate volume to help us with scale? What strategic value does a given model offer us? It may not be big into volume, but it may be a big image play for us that you need in the lineup. And then which vehicles add profitability? If you have vehicles in your lineup that have no strategic value, don't offer you any value, and you're not making money on, chances are you need to get out of that business. And in the past, you didn't need to. You know, I look at, we had a model lineup called Scion that I happened to start, and it lasted about 10 years. We sold about 1 million vehicles. And people often ask, why did you get out of that business? 1 million vehicles, a lot of people take 1 million vehicles out. Fact of the matter is, its strategic value had run its course. It allowed us to add more emotion to our vehicles from a fun-to-drive aspect and from a styling aspect. It allowed us to work with our dealers to understand digital marketing and event marketing. So at a point in time, there was no strategic value left in that, and I'd rather take those dollars and put it against new SUVs today or a future of autonomous vehicles.
Speaking of that, you know, what you got to do today, what's your sense of what's going on in the market right now? Every time I pick up the paper or turn on the radio or the TV, I'm hearing some pundits say, oh, car sales are slowing down, everything's slowing down, woe is us. And I look at a 17.4 million SAR that we ended up last month, and mm-hmm. I think, boy, we've only slowed down to a steady roar. What's your sense of what's going on?
You're exactly right. I mean, you know, last year, when we were forecasting this year's market, we had forecasted the market to be about 16.8. It was going to drop about 400,000 units. We're going to end up at about 17.2. And if you look at just the retail portion of that, to really judge the strength of the marketplace, from February through November, the market was either the same as the prior month or went up every single month except for October. And it dropped by a tenth. So when I look at that, the industry looks quite strong. You know, one can look at incentive spend and residual values and some other things, and there are some warning signs we have to watch for to make sure that we're not falling into kind of the habits of the past to boost an industry, and we lose a little bit of sight of the business. But I think the industry's strong. And I think, you know, barring some crazy trade things, I think next year's industry is probably going to be down slightly, maybe 300,000 or 400,000 units. But I was wrong this year too. It could be the same again. Mm-hmm. And as we look at a longer term view out to 2025, we see an average industry of 16.6 million. And that assumes sometime between now and then, there's going to be some dip in the overall economy. So we're still very, very bullish on the overall market.
We're seeing a historic shift in the American market. In fact, it's a global trend, away from passenger sedans mm-hmm. into crossovers, SUVs, and pickups. You guys are still very strong in passenger cars.
Yeah.
Yet, I think before this year is over, we'll see passenger car sedans in the U.S. market drop by almost 800,000 units. It's a massive drop. And last year it dropped, and the year before it dropped, and the year before it dropped.
Right.
When do we hit bottom, and do you guys stick with your plan of staying with them?
You know, last month was actually 29%, so it fell below 30%. It's the rate of decline in passenger car business has been slowing the second half of the year. So, you know, I think it's going to be somewhere around 70-30. I think we're getting fairly close to that equilibrium. Could it be 72 or 73% light truck? Next up, it might be. But it's going to be pretty close to that. And the way we look at the market is if you're going to be a full-line manufacturer, which we want to be, and you look at the passenger car market, it is actually coming in below the deep recession we had in 2010. So there is a depression on the passenger car side. That said, you've got the subcompact segment that Corolla and Civic plays in. You've got the midsize car, which is Camry and Avalon and Prius. Those two segments are both going to be probably 1.8 million. Still two great big segments. And if you look at the luxury side, you've got near luxury, it's going to be about 400,000. Those three segments are 80% of the passenger car business. So with those three segments over 4 million units, there's no way I'm going to walk away from that. And we are always going to have a bias towards passenger cars. I think Honda is as well. So as others walk away from those markets, maybe a few more walk away, that won't be too bad for me.
Hey, you brought up tariffs, so I'm just going to ride on what you said. We've got the three top European CEOs were just in the White House, I guess, yesterday.
Yep.
What do you think's going to happen? I mean, we've already got tariffs on steel and aluminum, at least with Canada and Mexico. That'll probably be negotiated away, probably.
Hopefully.
But, you know, now we've got GM announcing plant closings, Ford's announcing at least shifting some of the production. I got to believe the president of the United States is going to believe more in tariffs now for imported cars than ever before. What's your read?
Hopefully that's not the case. You know, if you look at the three big buckets of tariffs, you know, one are the steel tariffs, and Bob is here. We're just talking to suppliers now. We are over 90% U.S. source steel, and our cost is up 40%. So we're buying from U.S. sources, and it's still up 40%. That's a result of the 25% tariff. And I know that Ford and GM also buy heavily in the U.S., and their costs are up as well. So everybody is seeing cost push on a per unit basis of anywhere from $100 to $400 just on steel alone. You've got the new NAFTA agreement, USMCA.
You got it.
So, yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it is.
It always starts with US, so that's how I remember it. And while we're pleased that something's been signed, it's something that it is the most aggressive country of origin trade agreement in the automotive sector in the entire world. It was before it was negotiated. Now it's even stronger. There's a labor component of that. But we're confident that we can make both of those deals. The challenge becomes that still has to get through the U.S. Congress. And I'm sure there will be fireworks before it's over. You know, we think it's going to probably take almost all year. There will try to be modifications made to it. My sense is that our president probably isn't going to want modifications. And he will go around long enough, and at some point he's going to say, you know what, here's what we're going to do. I'm getting out of NAFTA. You've got two choices. Either my deal I negotiated or no NAFTA whatsoever. That could be devastating for the industry. So we're all taking a deep breath that it's over. It's not over yet. So that is still a little bit of uncertainty out there. The third big bucket is this 232, where imported vehicles and parts are considered a threat to national security, which nothing could be further from the truth. And that's a risk for all OEMs. There's not a single vehicle made in the U.S. that's 100% U.S. made and sourced. Camry, as an example, is one of the most U.S. parts on a vehicle made in the U.S. That vehicle goes up about $1,800. The price of Tundra truck goes up $2,800. Sienna van goes up $3,000. When you add that up across the entire industry, the forecast is that a 25% tariff on all imported vehicles and parts reduces the overall industry by over 2 million vehicles a year. So you have an industry that goes from 17 to 15 million as a result. It's going to have a huge impact on dealers. Customers are going to be paying more. It's going to have a huge impact on parts suppliers. And if you throw a little recession on top of that sometime down the road, now you're looking at an industry that could be 13.5. So I just don't think it makes sense. I understand that everyone says this is a negotiating tactic, but just remember that all of the tariff threats that have been out there have been put in place if the president didn't get what he wanted. So I've got to take him for his word, and that if he doesn't get what he wants, he's going to put it in place. So to me, that is the most potential for devastation in the industry, an industry that we know what the brink is like, and we never want to get there again.
Real good. Let's go to a lighter subject for the moment
to wrap
this up. Yeah. The North American International Auto Show right around the corner. Ooh. You guys, I don't know if this is officially announced yet, but
it's a big secret.
It's a big secret that you're going to introduce the Supra.
Yep.
So tell us about what your plans are for the show, and especially with that car, bringing it back.
Well, this is a real labor of love for Akio Toyota. Akio learned how to become a professional race car driver with a Supra. And the gentleman that taught him how to do that was tragically killed in a car accident at a track a couple years ago. So this is a real personal thing for Akio. It's taken us a while. It's like a fine wine. It's been gone for 20 years. It seems like it's taken us about 10 years to bring it back. But the reason for that is Akio wanted to make sure this car was perfect. So he has been the guy that has really seasoned the ride and handling of this car to be absolutely perfect. And it will be that. It's going to be exciting.
I remember when the Supra was at a level that it was almost a race car itself. I mean, if you had put slicks on it, you could absolutely take it on a track and really do some damage. It's amazing to me the amount of performance that we're able to get today. Mm-hmm. Is this going to be an Uber performance car or what? And I don't mean Uber the ride share.
Yeah. It may not fit in the back seat of this one. If I told you, I'd have to shoot you.
Well, I know. You'd have to shoot us all, but...
It will be a performance machine, and you'll see all the spec on it just in about a month from now.
Real good. We're going to wrap up the session right now, and I'd like to invite Rod back up to the stage, because I know we've got some of your questions that we'd like to get to as well.
Pressure's on.
Thanks, John. By the way, you guys sent in some great questions, and I think they're still rolling in. We got them all over this pad up here. So I'm going to start with a couple here. But to kick things off, with passenger cars sales in steep decline due to the market shift to larger SUVs and trucks, what is Toyota's strategy to manage this in terms of manufacturing plant underutilization, new model introductions, et cetera?
Sure. So if you look at our car-based plants, Kentucky being the biggest, we're running about 85% capacity on the Camry Avalon line, almost 90% on the ES line. Probably the plant at the lowest capacity right now is 78%, and that's Mississippi with Corolla. But we have an all new Corolla coming in the spring, and that capacity is going to be back up to almost 95%. So, you know, we have always tried not to overcapacitize ourselves. So we feel like we're in really good shape. The truck plants are humming along. You know, we've got expansion coming with our plant in Mexico. We've got the Alabama plant in 2021 that'll be building a few more Corollas for us. So we think the footprint is in the right place, and capacity is actually quite good.
That's great. Thank you. What is your impression of GM and Ford's restructuring moves, and how Toyota will restructure itself in the wake of the changing auto industry?
You know, you've got a bunch of really smart people at both of those companies. And they've looked at their situation, they've looked at their future, and they're taking aggressive action to make sure that they position themselves for that future. So I'm never gonna question what another OEM does. We're maybe in a little bit different position. You know, if you look at our totaled salaried headcount in the US, including the finance company, our total is about 12,000 people. So we've always been a fairly lean organization. As we made our move to Plano, Texas, and combined a number of these different companies, at that point in time, we took advantage of efficiencies. Each group had their own HR team. They had their own legal team. They had their own finance team. Now that they're all under one roof together, we were able to reduce some of the headcount there. So I think we've already kind of gone through all that, and we're very confident at the numbers we're at right now.
Yeah. You know, we had the Q&A with the students earlier, and I thought this other question that came out along that line again, you've announced the intention to become a mobility company, not just a car company. Can you give us your definition of what that means from Toyota and how it'll impact your present and future customers?
Yeah, I mean, again, to me, mobility is about helping people get across town or across the room, because mobility means different things to different people. And frankly, if we can help with assistance with people with disabilities, from a societal standpoint, that's probably the most important type of mobility you can offer someone. Wheelchairs, assistance for the blind, exoskeletons, all of that is in our plans. And you know, the other piece of it is, as we see more and more people move into the cities, you know, it's said that by 2050, almost 70% of the U.S. population will be in metro environments. So there's got to be a way to figure out how personal transportation fits in to public transportation. And the challenge has always been that last mile. We're not going to have a subway system or a train system like Japan does, where you can get within a block of where you want to go. It's just difficult to retrofit cities to that. People don't like riding buses. So we're going to figure out how we can work with cities to find devices, I don't want to call them vehicles, things like the iRoad, where people can use their cell phones to drive that last 15 minutes from their home to a station or from station to work. So that's part of the mobility challenge as well.
How do you guys see Toyota collaborating with the tech industry to bring self-driving vehicles to the market?
You know, I call it cooperation. We need to cooperate with each other, but we have to realize we're also in competition with each other. So, you know, our TRI team, our research team, the Trina team here that's also working on future, whether they're flying cars or whether they're mobility vehicles, we will have to work hand in hand with tech. I think we both have certain skill sets that we can lend each other. They are very, very quick. Their clock moves very fast. Our clock moves a little bit slower, but in this industry, with the precision, we have to do everything that's required.
Do you favor federal or state laws overseeing this autonomous future we have?
They have to be federal laws.
Yep.
The difficult, imagine if you had a patchwork of state laws, and you're leaving California, driving to Arizona, and there's a different law that may prohibit you from bringing that car in, especially a real simple one of steering wheels. Imagine that you have a state that allows an autonomous vehicle without a steering wheel, and you need to drive across the state that requires them, and your car doesn't have one. What are you going to do? So I think it's really, really important that we have federal law.
You mentioned earlier when we had the kids about part of the reason why you brought everything to Plano, or to, you might want to cover that a little bit too, but what other ideas do you have down the road that you'd want to do as CEO while you're there too? Do you have things in mind right now along with you, that move you made, which is a big move to consolidate?
Yeah, so I'll touch on the consolidation first. Most people think of Toyota as a company in the US, and we're actually not. We started off back in the 50s as a distributor. Over time, when we added manufacturing in the 80s, TEMA became basically the headquarters operations for manufacturing and for R&D, Erlanger, Kentucky, close to the Georgetown plant. We added a finance company, also in California. We added a holding company that was in New York City. So in the end, we ended up literally with four different corporations reporting back to different groups in Japan, spread out across the US, across all these different time zones. And we're a consensus-driven company. So it takes time to get everybody on the same page. And that was okay when the world moved a lot slower. But today, when the most important aspect of a corporation is agility, that wasn't gonna work. So when I became CEO for North America in 2013, Akio Toyota asked me, what's the one thing you can do to make sure that our business is sustainable for the next 50 years? And I told him we need to get the company under one roof. And that's where this whole concept of One Toyota came about, where we moved the manufacturing headquarters to Texas, sales operations to Texas, the holding company from New York into Texas, the finance company into Texas, and R&D, although they report in, are still here in Michigan where they need to be. And that allows us to be much, much quicker. As I said before, you know, the future is uncertain in terms of how we're going to get to where we all need to be. So everyone needs to set their strategy and set their plan, but we have to be extremely agile and be willing to change at a moment's notice. We can do that now with the way we're structured. It makes a big difference. You know, in terms of the future, where am I from here? We began a process about 6 years ago to look at our manufacturing footprint, to try to get similar type vehicles built in similar parts of North America. And that was really to try to reduce logistics cost on the parts side. And once we went through that, the truck market was so strong that it kind of screwed things up on us, because we were going to build Corollas in Guanajuato, Mexico, but I added and added and added truck production, and even last month our Tacoma sales were up 20%. I still have a shortage of pickups. So we decided to move pickup trucks into Guanajuato and then do this joint venture with Mazda in the Alabama plant for Corolla. So, you know, I thought I was done with that footprint thing. I guess what I've learned is I'm never going to be done with a footprint change. It's always going to be evolving.
Thanks. Of course, I'm in the dealership side of it too, with the auto show and the car dealers. But with this, the whole change with ride-sharing platforms, and knowing how it's going to impact dealers in the future, is it going to be somewhat great impact to that all the way around, or is it going to be minimal?
We want them as our partners.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the biggest impact maybe on dealers is the impact that ride-sharing and car-sharing has on private ownership. I am not a believer that it's taking it over. I hear many journalists talk about private ownership is dead. Everyone, you know, why would you ever want to own a car? Those are people that typically live in New York and live in San Francisco, where they haven't owned a car anyway. So I'm not a believer in that. You know, there was an analogy someone gave once, you know, cars are only used 5% of the time, so why not share it? Well, toothbrushes are 5% of the time too. And I'm not gonna share my toothbrush anytime soon. So, and you know, I happen to have a son that has two granddaughters, 1 and 3. And if you've ever seen the inside of a car with two small children, that's not being shared either. So I think there are reasons where car sharing makes sense and ride sharing makes sense, but it's not going to end private ownership of vehicles. So I think the dealers are safe in that regard. And in terms of mobility as a service, our plan is to include our dealers in that. I mean, we'd be crazy not to leverage 1,500 dealers from around the country that can help us in satisfying that customer need.
That was a great answer. this is more on the personal side, but did you have an event in your life that meant the most to your current success? Because you started right there at the, not the bottom, I guess, pretty close.
I started with Ford Motor Company back in 19, and that doesn't mean the bottom. that came out wrong, I'm sorry. I learned a lot from Ford Motor Company. I worked for Phil Novell. That's how I started in the Denver region. So I was 4 years with Ford. In fact, my 40th anniversary in the auto business was December 1st. And probably the biggest change I had in my life, I had left Ford, joined Toyota in Portland, Oregon. And I had kind of an old school boss at the time. And we had just had a really good month, and he got all of the district managers, I was running the district managers at the time, all of us together. And he just berated us for an hour about how awful we were. And this was a kind of my way or the highway, old school kind of guy. And he dismissed the guys and he said, I know you didn't like what I did, but he said, your problem is you're too easy on people. And unless you're going to change your attitude and how you motivate people, you don't have a future with this company. And he sent me home, and he said, I want you to think about it for the weekend, and come back Monday, and either you're going to change, or you're gonna have to find another job somewhere else. So that was a difficult weekend. I had left a successful career at Ford. I had two small children. There was no plan B for me. This was it. And I had to decide, was I gonna have to change who I am to please my boss? And it was really the first time in my life that I really understood who I was. And I understood what my core values were. and what my North Star was. And it ends up that I went in and told him he's going to have to fire me because I wasn't going to change. He was a nice guy, though. He gave me 2 weeks to find another job, and I did. I took a demotion, went to our corporate office, and started things over again. But it's when I really realized how you can be successful in a company. Because when I was at Ford, I was successful, but I wasn't really happy, and I didn't know why. And it's because my core values didn't match that of the company's. You know, I was into teamwork and into respect for individuals. And no offense to Ford, it's a great company. And people that really want to be in charge of their own careers by themselves, it's a great place to advance. But that wasn't me. And I was lucky enough to find that my core values matched those of the company. And I think that's why things have worked well for me. The only thing I regret, though, is that when I became president of the company, this guy resigned about 6 hours before I had a chance to talk to him. Yeah. That would have been fun.
A story for another day, right? Yeah. Well, you've had some amazing answers. I'm going to call that the last question. Mm. I feel like I'm in Cash Cab. You see that? We're going into the lightning round.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I'm going to hit 8 or 10 questions and just have a second or two to answer each one.
Oh, boy.
Again, we're going to close it out, get to know you a little bit better. So first, something on your bucket list.
I'd love to see Machu Picchu. Never been there.
Yeah, that's good. Person you'd love to have lunch with?
They must, alive or dead?
Either way.
It's hard to have them when they're dead, I guess. Probably Henry Kissinger. I think he was a brilliant strategist, and in today's difficult world, I'd love to see what he thinks on how we do things.
Excellent. One of your favorite songs?
A Whole Lot of Love, Led Zeppelin.
All right.
I'm an old rocker.
We only had that piped in here right now. It'd be a perfect time. Favorite team growing up?
Chicago Blackhawks.
Excellent.
I was back in the days of Bobby Hull and Stan Mikita, and it was a good time. We used to play Detroit every now and then.
Beautiful. Your best sport?
My best?
Yeah. I guess that sport. Meant what you play. Did you play sports?
I played hockey till I was 50, but probably golf. I still...
Really good.
About a 8 handicap.
Hmm. Do you get to play in Japan at all? Is that the place you play?
I don't. I mean, Japan, it's typically airport, train, office, hotel, yeah. Repeat.
Yeah. Got to get it done, yeah. Probably good call. Last book you read?
The last book actually was a little book from Toyota that was written back in 1939. And it was written by a number of different people from the day, including the founder, really about the core principles of the company. And it was really interesting to see how valid they still are today. It was just translated into English in, I think, 99, but it was quite interesting.
One of your favorite movies?
Favorite movie, Field of Dreams. I'm a dreamer.
Excellent. Favorite vacation spot? I'm looking for a place to go.
Favorite vacation spot? Probably New Zealand. It's a fabulous place, fabulous people. Long way to get to, but it's well worth it if you haven't been.
Excellent. We're down to the last two. It's not too bad so far. Good. Describe Detroit in one word.
Resilient.
Good. And lastly, advice to your 25-year-old self.
Let's see. Take better care of your health. Probably be patient. You know, I think when you're 25, You're always trying to think about where do I want to be in 2 years or 5 years and 10 years. And I think sometimes you miss the opportunity to really build a strong foundation. And you know, now that's what I tell a lot of young people that I talk to, is taking lateral moves in whatever company you're in is a good thing to do. Because the stronger your foundation can be over time, it's going to make you a much, much stronger leader over time.
Great final answer. Jim, thanks again for your answers, amazing performance today. And John McElroy, always a pleasure to be with you too. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
It's awesome.
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks, everybody.
Let me just add a couple of thank yous really quick. Jim Lentz, I'm adding a whole lot of love to my Spotify playlist, and I'll think of you every time. So thank you. John McElroy, terrific job as always. Rod Alberts, thanks for all you do. Great job as moderator. A quick thank you to Kurt McAllister. Thank you for your efforts making this happen. And ladies and gentlemen, this will be the last meeting for 2018.
Thank you.
Happy holidays. See you in 2019. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.